Thank you for the introduction. It's a great honour for me to be able to address you on this very special anniversary Mark edition. When I was invited, I was told that this was actually the 40th year that this conference exists. And of course, that's the theme of the conference as well. So I started to think about what it is I'm going to talk about today. Of course, if this conference has been here for 40 years, people will start looking back at things, trying to take stock, see where we stand, see how we've progressed over time. But then, of course, 40 years is such a long period of time. Much has happened in that period. A lot has changed over time. So it's really difficult to actually make a pick in what to discuss. So I decided, of course, I've got 40 minutes, 45 minutes, that I can't be complete. Now, if you cannot be complete, then you might as well be shamelessly partial. And that's what I'm going to do. I'm just going to take out a few important topics, that is, topics that I find important. Partial also means biased, of course. So I'm just going to select a few things that are very close to my heart that I really want to talk about. And that's what I'm going to address. And the main theme I'm going to focus on is how in management, accounting and control research, we seem to have moved away at least a bit from studying individual instruments of control in isolation to a slightly more encompassing picture of packages and systems, and that's going to be the main theme. But let me first start with a very generic definition of management control, and this is where we started. Management control, by definition, is about the instruments and processes that organizations use to affect the behavior of people in the organization in order, in turn, to affect organizational effectiveness. So this is what we study. This is what we're trying to do. We're trying to see how control choices via human behavior affect the performance of the organization. Now, of course, and I'm pretty sure David Otley will talk about that a lot as well, we know that everything also depends on the circumstances. So if you want to study these relationships, we should take into account contingency factors because they really sort of determine also what goes on. So this sort of visualizes as a sort of starting point what we come from when we look at management control issues. This is, I would say, by definition, what management control is all about. Now the point is, however, that these control choices are many, many fold. There are many different choices that organizations need to make when they design their control packages, when they design their control structures. And Wim's voice here, just to illustrate how broad the set of questions would be, if we talk about management control, we think about action controls, like action accountability controls, behavioral constraints, pre-action reviews. We also talk about result controls, like reward and incentive structures, performance measurement systems, and of course we've got people controls, culture, organizational culture, training, employee selection, and organizations, when configuring their control structures, they make choices in all these different domains. Now I see this slide, by the way, I noticed that I made it look as if Wim does all the thinking. I'm not sure whether that is correct, but I just give you credit for it. Okay. So many, many choices that need to be made. And the point is that these choices that organizations make are not interdependent on each other. It matters what you choose in one sort of set of instruments, how other set of instruments will work out. And that's, of course, easy to see. If you've got a budget, then that gives direction to people and people start working towards meeting budget targets. And that gets intensified if there's also this incentive being tied to the budget. So that's the sort of interrelationships we would typically talk about. So there are many, many different individual choices that organizations need to make when they design their management control structures. And these choices are not interdependent of each other. Now, that is not a new thought. Of course, this is also about history. It's also about looking back and looking forward. And I came across this really nice paper of David Otley. Hi, David. There you are. And almost 40 years ago, in this seminal paper called Almost 1,800 Quotes Cites on Google Scholar, David observed that what constitutes an appropriate accounting information system, he was talking about accounting information systems as part of the total set of management controls that we need to study, that accounting information system will be influenced by the other control choices, the other control processes that are complementary to the accounting information system. That's one of the earliest quotes in the literature actually specifying that there are these interrelationships between individual control choices. And then he went on to say, it's often impossible to separate the effect of an individual element of control from the other controls. They act as a package and must be assessed jointly. So that's 1980. This is already sort of a preview of what comes in the next few years. So this is not a new thought. This thought goes back a long time, and this paper has had a huge influence. It's been quoted a lot, so it really has sort of molded our thinking along these lines. So if you then go back to the original definition of what management control is all about, we need to sort of redo our thinking and now take into account that the individual choices we make, the instruments of control, are interdependent and affect each other's working. So it's no longer really useful just to look at individual choice of control. We need also, apart from the contingency factors, also take into account the rest of the control structure if we want to understand how control choices affect organizational effectiveness via the behavior of individuals. So this sort of defines the challenge we as researchers face in management control, and you also as practitioners face in designing effective control systems. You need to understand how these interrelationships work out in order to address this question of management control structure effectiveness. So how could you do that? Think back about Wim telling us that control choices are manifold, people action controls, action accountability controls, behavior constraints, pre-action reviews, we've got result controls, we've got people controls. So how are we going to take into account all these different choices? If there are so many elements, so many different things to pick from, how are we going to think through all these interrelations that we need to understand in order to see how all that affects organizational functioning? One way to go about this is the configuration approach. In this configurational approach, people acknowledge that these interrelationships exist, but they also argue that many of the potential combinations that you could think of on paper, they can't exist in reality. Why not? Because they're internally inconsistent. Think for instance, about an organization that has chosen to decentralize because that is something this organization believes would help them function properly. So if you've got this decentralized organization and you need that level of decentralization, it doesn't really make sense also to have this really strong emphasis, for instance, on action accountability controls. If on the one hand you feel that people must be allowed some freeway to make their own choices, while on the other hand you really limit their freedom by investing really heavily in all sorts of procedures, in all sorts of rules and all that, then that doesn't really make sense. So some of the combinations of control choices that could exist on paper, they can't exist in reality because they are internally inconsistent. And then the next step, of course, is to develop the idea that, okay, if this is true, then you could expect that what you observe in the real world would be a limited set of clusters of control choices that are internally consistent and that sort of help each other, are complementary, and are, as a set, able to affect the sort of behavior the organization wants to achieve. So even though you've got all these choices that on paper could be defined, could be combined in many, many different ways, in practice you would only see a few subsets of these because these are the subsets that are internally consistent. And one of the earliest examples that I came across of this configurational thinking would probably be Burns and Stalker back in 1961. That's a long time ago. It's even longer ago than 40 years. And they distinguished between these mechanistic and organic organizations that they described as sets of internally consistent design choices within the organization. Another great example would be the work of Ucci. He distinguishes market, bureaucracies, and clans, all defined as internally consistent sets of control choices that, as a set, in their entirety, affects the behavior of organizations. This is another one, slightly less famous, I would say. I've done some work in this as well. I had five configurations, but that doesn't seem to work. When I did this paper 18 years ago, I felt this was progress. So we've got person stalker. They've got two types, right? Mechanistic and organic organization. Then Ucci came along. He had three types: market, bureaucracies, and clans. I had five types. That was a major step ahead, right? Arm's length, machine of the action-oriented type, machine of the result-oriented type, exploratory and boundary control. So I actually felt that I was progress. How wrong I was. This is just sort of illustrating the value of simplicity. This plots the number of sites these papers got over the years, plotted against the number of types that they distinguish. And what you can now see is that even if you correct for the age of these papers, so the Burns and Stalker paper has been around for, how much is it, almost 60 years now, I would say. My paper, only like 18 years, so my paper is just allowed to drink, whereas their paper is about to retire. But even if you're correct for that, you would see that if you increase the number of types you distinguish, your quotes go down. Burns and Stalker had almost 18,000 quotes, I think. Ucci, 7,000. My paper, a lousy 400. So forget about my paper and just go back to Burns and Stalker and Ucci, for that matter. Okay, so this is the configurational approach. Now, this configurational approach has proven, I would say, quite valuable in that it sort of offers us a perspective to look at things. It really helps to look at the complexity of reality from this sort of nice, simple perspective of having this view sets of configurations that you can choose from in time to address your control challenges. That really helps us think through these issues. But they have been quite difficult to establish empirically. On paper, that would be really easy. The only thing you've got to do if you want to test these theories is to sort of define the ideal types. So you need to define the ideal market. You need to define the ideal bureaucracy. You need to define the ideal clan. And if you've got that defined, if you've got that pointed down, so you specify these in their composition, then the only thing you've got to do is you go to a set of firms, you measure their control systems, you measure the distances, the differences between their actual choices and the ideal types, and of course you would hope that if these distances, these differences are larger, then that would be associated with less organizational performance. So on paper, that's really easy to do. In practice, the practice of research, that has turned out to be incredibly difficult because it is theoretically so demanding. It's a really daunting task, really, to operationalize these ideas of these archetypes in measurable terms that you can use as benchmarks against what you observe in reality. So theoretically, and from a sort of eye-opening perspective, this has been wonderful, but empirically, it hasn't been all that worked through, all that well worked through. So how, if we want to study these interrelationships, if you want to take into account all these different connections between elements of the structure, how do we go about empirically? There's David again. He warned us for that. I said, this is unrealistic to expect that you can do this empirically using statistical methods. They're just not sort of sophisticated enough. There's too much complexity. You can't boil that down to simple statistical tools. That's again 40 years ago. Well, this is still pretty much true, I would say. So, yes, thank you for warning us. But still, there has been a bit of progress. We've made tiny little baby steps to move beyond that sort of things, that sort of verdict that we can't do anything. One way to do this would be to study conditional correlations. That's, for instance, something that Grabner and Moore tell us to do. What you do essentially is you look at control practices that you observe in reality, You try to explain them from contingency factors.
Then there is this residual that you cannot explain. And if the residuals correlate, then that would be evidence of complementarities. I'm not going to go into the details too much. This works, and this has actually also stimulated quite a stream of research looking at these complementarities. The problem, however, with this is that you could only do pairwise complementarities. So you could look at, for instance, performance-based pay and subjective performance evaluation, so pairs can be done. But if you want to extend that beyond just the pairs, then it's going to be more complicated. And remember, control choice are manifold, so designing a control structure comes down to making a whole bunch of choices at the same time. So we need to be able to move beyond these pairwise dichotomies. And there has been some progress in that as well. And that refers to a working paper of mine that I have with Sally Whitener and Frank Verbeeten. And essentially what we say is, so you can have as many practices as you like. If they are complements, if they sort of support each other, if they're part of really a system, that it should actually be true that if you apply factor analysis, that you should be able to identify the commonality in these control choices, and that commonality then should be able to relate that, to connect that to some outcome variable like performance, if you like, and all that. So this is a progress, and we seem to have been moving beyond this idea that simply using statistical methods we cannot do anything. Just to illustrate this thought, how that could work out, let's have a look at the stream of literature that has evolved around the sort of paradox between creativity and control. I'm sure you all know that organizations would value both creativity and control. Of course, they value control. I'm in management control. Come on, this is my show, right? So they value control, but they would also value creativity as a source for innovation, as a source for renewal. So organizations want to have both. Of course, they differ in the extent to which they want creativity. They differ in the extent to which they want control. But as a very sort of generic starting point, they would both value creativity and control. Now, it's often argued that the two do not go together. Control kills creativity. Many people would say that that is in fact the case. If you want to have creativity, you can't really have control. If you want to have control, you must be able to give up on your creativity. This is just a cartoon to illustrate that. So yes, of course, this dog cannot really do tricks because it's sort of aligned and tied in all that well. So this is a challenge that organizations need to face. They somehow must be successful in trying to balance, on one hand, control, on the other hand, creativity. That's at least what the starting point would be. So how do organizations cope with that tension? How do they do that? How do they go about that? Before I'm going to talk about that a bit more, I think we need to sort of dispel some myth. Three people. Do you know who these people are? Who are they? Van Gogh, Amy Winehouse. Who's the other one? Beethoven, yes. He's the composer of that piece of music that later became adopted as the European anthem, you know that? Not very popular nowadays, I suppose. So Van Gogh, Beethoven, and Amy Winehouse. What do these people have in common? They're all dead, yes. What else? They're really creative people, right? They make wonderful things. So they're creative, they're dead, they're creative. Anything else? They all had serious mental problems. So Van Gogh was, of course, really depressed, like the London weather today. Beethoven had a bipolar disorder. Amy Winehouse was, well, completely messed up, I would say. So they all have mental problems. So if these are the people you would depend on for your creativity, I'm pretty sure you want to have some controls in place. So that's one thing. The other thing is this. If you think about creativity, we do have all these warm feelings about that, all these warm associations. So creative people are great people. Well, they're not. They can be really disturbed. But also that the outcomes of creativity is valuable in and by itself. Now, these are great
I would say, results of creative behavior, but I'm pretty sure that not many people would want to invest in these marvelous inventions. So, if we think about creativity, we must take into account that creativity may also come at a price and that these people can perhaps be a bit difficult to sort of cope with, to manage, and also not all creativity, not all product of creative behavior is actually worthwhile for a firm. So there's no intrinsic value, I would say, in creativity, and that somehow needs to be tied in. So this also sort of illustrates that, okay, so there may be this tension between control and creativity, but it's not necessarily true that if you want to have control, you can let go of control. So that's a bit of a problem. Anyway, if you look at the organizational behavior literature, there is a lot of support for this incompatibility thesis, this idea that you can't have both. That's a lot of support in that particular area. But then again, what do they know? These people in this area, they tend to have really sort of restricted notions as to what management control would be all about. So they operationalize control in their studies as the sort of red tape type of control, or the really sort of primitive characteristic approaches. So if they study control and study how that affects creative behavior, they tend to have this really sort of narrow definition of what they consider to be control. We, of course, as management accounting and control practitioners and scholars, we know that control is actually much, much broader than just that. This concept of control is much broader. And if you take that into account, perhaps this also helps you to think more productively about this tension between control and creativity. Take, for instance, this wonderful paper by Isabella Grabner. So she started her study with this observation that creativity-dependent firms, firms that need creativity for renewal, that are dependent on the creativity of their employees in order for them to be successful, they do, in fact, rely on performance-based pay. And what we know from this organizational behavior literature and all the experiments they've done is that you cannot really design incentive structures that would sort of elicit creative behavior in people. It's no use to say, okay, if you get creative, I'll give you a bonus. And in order to get that bonus, you must be creative to this sort of level. That just don't work. And the organizational behavior has documented that quite convincingly. Yet she observes that creativity-dependent organizations nevertheless rely on performance-based pay. So what's going on here? Are these organizations stupid? Haven't they read anything over their years? Well, probably not. Because she also observes that these organizations, they also combine their performance-based pay with a subjective performance evaluation that sort of values new skill development, orientation towards longer-term goals of the organization, that values cooperation. So they've got two systems in place at the same time. They've got that performance-based pay, paying them for their contribution to organizational performance, measured sort of restricted in financial terms and all that. But then they also have this strong emphasis on subjective performance evaluation that values this broader set of dimensions of performance that are intuitively more related to creative behavior than the elements that go into this performance-based pay thing, right? And what she also observes is that more creativity dependence is actually associated with a stronger emphasis on both of these systems. So the organizations in her sample that really are dependent on the creative behavior of employees, they invest a lot in both of these structures at the same time. So they would have a strong emphasis on performance-based pay, but they would also have a really strong emphasis on subjective performance evaluation. And her interpretation of this is that, yes, you have this tension that could be there. you need to balance this tension. On the one hand, you need to stimulate people to engage in creative behavior, and these subjective performance dimensions, they come into play in that, because if you have this subjective performance evaluation, you don't have to define ex ante what it is you want from people. You can just work from what they offer you, that what you observe, and you can value creativity enhancing sort of elements in their performance. So that sort of stimulates creative behavior. On the other hand, you still need to have this performance dependent pain. Why? You need to constantly remind your people of the fact that creative behavior is an expensive game to play. It takes up a lot of organizational resources, and you better make sure that you're really selective in where to focus your creative behavior. So you need to be able to prevent poor creativity leading to all these weird inventions that I showed you just a few minutes ago on these slides, while at the same time emphasizing that you want people to be creative. And that combination works. So the interesting thing is that this sort of suggests that if creativity becomes important, control becomes more important. Organizations invest more in control if creativity is important. So that sort of contradicts the incompatibility thesis from organizational behavior literature. Let's take this just one step further. I've got some work in this area myself with Hilkoff and Elton, four PhD students of mine, and Sally Widener. And we start from this idea of Simons. Are you familiar with Simons, the Levers of Control framework? Many people would, right? Are there any fans of Simons' work here? Are there any Simonellas here? I can see, yeah. I can see you there, Bria, I can see Julia. So quite a few people have sort of embraced this. I've got a confession to make. I'm not particularly fond of Simons' work because I think he's a really lazy thinker. That's because he sort of refers to all these ideas about balance and all that without ever specifying what balance is. This is a sort of rhetoric trick, right? You need to have balance between the levers. Sure, you cannot be against balance, can you? You cannot say that you rather have unbalance than balance. So yes, people love balance, and we need to have balance. Then, of course, the question arises as to what is balance? So is balance the same of everything, or is it sort of something that is connected to what you actually need? Is it a contingent thing? Simons doesn't say anything about it, but still this idea that you've got various different levers that you can sort of rely on in order to affect control is an interesting thought, and we worked in this particular project from this perspective to think through what that could mean for creativity. So very briefly, the idea of Simons is that if you want to be in control of your strategy, you need to have four levers present: belief systems, boundary systems, interactive systems, and diagnostic systems. And they've all got their specific focus. They all got their specific role to play. In the belief systems, you emphasize core values. In the boundary systems, you emphasize risk to be avoided. In the interactive systems, you sort of focus on the strategic uncertainties and how you should adapt to that. You focus on learning and all that. And in the diagnostic systems, you focus on the critical performance variables, keeping things on track and all that. And you need to have all these four levers in place in order to be able successfully to manage your strategy. Of course, then you need to have balance and all that. So that's the key idea underlying this Simons framework. So that was one of our starting points. The other starting point was, okay, let's have a look at more psychologically oriented literature to try to understand the determinants, the factors that drive creative behavior. And then we came across this well-known theory, self-determination theory. That's got a lot to say about creative behavior. The key starting point of this approach is that in order to have creative behavior, in order to elicit creative behavior, you need to have some sort of sense of self-regulation. So only people that are self-regulated can engage in creative behavior. And self-regulated means that you've got the intrinsic motivation to contribute to creative outcomes. So you need to be able to see the fun in doing creative stuff on the one hand. But also you need to have this idea that engaging in that type of behavior is really important for you. Not just for you, but also for your environment, for your boss, or for your parents, or whatever. And in order to affect that sense of self-regulation, or in order to affect that state of self-regulation, you need to have two things in order. Autonomy support. If people do not feel in charge of their own destiny, they cannot really engage in creative behavior. So they must have this feeling that if they choose to engage in behavior in creative behaviors, that is their choice, essentially, and that is their intrinsic desire to do so. And that needs to be supported from the environment. So we need to have autonomy support. But we also need, and that's really interesting, we also need to provide structure. Now, of course, this idea that creativity is actually stimulated by structure is something that sort of goes against conventional wisdom a lot. But when you come to think of it, I would say it's time to debunk a few more myths. It doesn't really work that way. In fact, in arts, we do have many, many rules that help us create beautiful things. Think, for instance, about the rule of thirds or the golden rule. They help us organize our compositions in ways that really help us make beautiful things. So there are rules that we apply that help us to create a higher quality of creative products. So rules can actually help people in their creative endeavors. This other thing. Sometimes imposing these rules also stimulates people to think further. This is, of course, just an example, a sonnet by Shakespeare. So what's the interesting thing about sonnets? They've got all sorts of rules. You've got 14 lines, you've got a very specific metrum, you've got a very specific rhyme scheme, and all that, if you're an artist, if you're a poet, that this is self-imposed. People impose these additional rules to make it harder for themselves. But by doing so, that really sort of get their creative juices flowing, and it helps them to create wonderful things that we still have to read hundreds of years after they have been produced. So rules can actually help creativity by providing a sense of how to do things, like the rule of thirds or the golden rule and all that, or by making it more difficult, making the stakes a bit higher, and via that effect also stimulate people to become more creative than they would otherwise be able to be. So structure is actually also quite important for creative behavior. And everybody who has kids knows that, right? If you've got a young kid, like a five-year-old or a six-year-old, and you would give them a piece of paper and a set of pencils and say, okay, make a nice drawing, daddy will be really happy if you do so, nothing comes out. Only if you start talking to them, if you start guiding them, try to draw a sun. Yeah, we need to have radiance, whatever. Try to draw a person, a guy. No, they've got five fingers, not 10. So if you start helping them make the drawing, then the outcome of it is actually more valuable than if we do not do so. So structure can actually help. Okay, so we've got this idea from self-determination theory arguing that both autonomy support and structure are vital in order to stimulate creative behavior. Now, how does that connect with the Simons approach? Well, these belief systems, providing inspiration, providing direction when it comes to the core values of the organization, and interactive control, trying to engage people with what we're trying to do, trying to help them focus on new possibilities, trying to help them learn and all that goes to autonomy support. That really helps people to feel in charge of their own destiny. That feeds into intrinsic behavior, even though it's extrinsic control, becomes sort of ingrained in how people think. So that's the one part. And the other part, the structure, is provided by these boundary systems and these diagnostic controls, telling people what to do, telling people what we value, telling people when we value it, and all that. So there seems to be this match, and you need to have all four levers present in order actively to stimulate creative behavior. Belief systems and interactive systems to provide autonomy support, the boundary systems and the diagnostic systems to provide the necessary structure in order for this to succeed. Okay, so we need all four levers, and they are complements. We need to have them together They support each other, they strengthen each other's effects and all that. Does that work? Of course, this is just theory. This is just something we came up with, right? So we decided to test this in a larger survey. I think we had about 250 observations from business units, managers, and their creative behavior, and to sort of control their experience and all that. And our idea was essentially that, so if you want to pick up on this system of controls, essentially what we need to do is we need to look at the commonality of the four levers. So what we do is we apply this idea that I earlier introduced, this idea of factor analysis, looking at the overlap in each of these four levers, looking at the extent to which they move together, identifying that part and linking that to creativity and to empowerment. So we just apply a second order factor analysis to identify a commonality, and we believe that the commonality represents the system. So not just the individual levers, but the extent to which they actually sort of support each other, the extent to which they are interrelated. So that's our way to operationalize this idea. So this is just a technical note for the researchers in the room. And of course, then our idea was that if organizations invest more in this system, if they've got more of these overlap, more of these four levers together, then that would help them support empowerment and support creativity. And that, in fact, is what we find. If we look at this in our models, we do find quite convincing, I would say, support for these relationships to exist. So all this is positive. Now, of course, this is just one explanation of what we observe. And there are potential other explanations of what goes on. And we've tried a series of alternative models. For instance, what we did is we also looked at all of these individual levers at the same time, but not specifically the overlap, and see whether that would support creativity and empowerment. And that model doesn't work at all. It doesn't fit the data at all. We also argued, hey, perhaps this creative behavior is actually stimulated not by the four levers, but just by the positive levers, the yins or the yangs. I never know which is the positive ones, but the ones that are actually sort of valued by people as being positive, the beliefs and the interactive controls. So let's forget about the boundaries and the diagnostic controls. Just check whether this works. Didn't work at all. So essentially, in all these different specifications, we find consistent support that it is actually the overlap that drives these results. So that was really sort of an interesting outcome. So our conclusion actually was that control does not kill creativity. In spite of the conventional wisdom that has it that you cannot have the both, in fact, it is true that if you want to have creativity, you actually need a more intensive reliance on the control system. Isabella Grabner already showed that creativity-dependent firms have this stronger emphasis both on performance-based pay and subjective performance evaluation. We also see that if they have a stronger emphasis on the system as a whole, that is associated with positive outcomes in terms of empowerment and creativity, also directly and indirectly and all that. So this actually illustrates a much broader theme, and that's the theme I was, of course, just trying to talk about today, that the whole is in fact different from the sum of this part, and that ignoring these systemic effects between components of the structure may lead to erroneous conclusions. You need to have this almost, I hate the word, holistic view in order to fully understand what goes on in management control. There are these interrelationships. You need to take them into account. If you forget about that, it would be the same as just forgetting about contingency factors. You would forget about the juice, and you would forget about all the important and interesting things. A while ago, I showed this quote from David. There it is again. Statistical methods can't really solve that problem. And that, of course, is still true. So this is just beginning to emerge, I would say. And we're only beginning to understand how we could go about modeling these interrelationships. And I think we've made some interesting progress, but it's still true that you can only apply this if you really sort of are willing to define a really narrow sort of outcomes.
We, in this case, looked at creativity, so we could do that. But this other paper in which we look at effectiveness in providing direction and all that. But that's still very limited, and it's still sort of baby steps, but there has been progress. And if you then look at these 40 years that have passed since, I would say, okay, yes, we can. Thank you.